Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the March 4th, 2012 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, the podcast devoted to the discussion of news and politics from the perspective of Ayn Rand's philosophy, objectivism. I'm your host, Amy Peikoff, and here's what I have planned today. First, I'm happy to say an interview with Kira Peikoff, author of the recently released thriller, her first novel called Living Proof. And then later we've got Mitt Romney's position on the individual mandate of Obamacare. Is it actually what he said during the campaign, that he thinks it's only appropriate at the state level? We will also discuss Andrew Breitbart, the activist, writer, publisher who died unexpectedly this week. Also, Obama talking tough on Iran. Does it mean anything? And a few more things. But I want to get first right now into our discussion with Kira Peikoff, because she can be with us only for a short time. Kira, thanks for taking time out of your busy promotion schedule. The book was just released a couple days ago, right?
Yes, and thank you so much for having me. I'm really happy to be on.
So what inspired you to write this novel, Living Proof?
Well, it's actually a kind of a long story. It's not exactly like I just suddenly had an epiphany and then sat down to write this book one day. I knew I'd always wanted to write a novel, and it was a matter of finding the right idea, one that could sustain 300 pages and however many years of my dedication. So in college, I was studying journalism, and I held several internships, reporting internships, and one of them happened to be in Washington, D.C. in the summer of 2006. And during that time, I went to the White House to cover one of my assignments, which was President Bush's first veto of his whole presidency, and it was to deny funding for stem cell research.
Okay.
And I felt that this act was a complete betrayal of science because of religion in government. And I found it really difficult to go back to my office and write a fair and balanced piece for the newspaper, which was the Orange County Register. And I felt that I was frustrated, and I wanted to express what I saw were life and death stakes in this issue. And I wanted to dramatize that in a way that I felt would be relatable and understandable. And the best way that I knew how and had always been drawn to was through fiction. So that was the genesis of the idea.
Right. Now, to be clear, it's not that the federal government should be funding all sorts of scientific research, but it's the issue of the government choosing not to fund this particular research because of religious issues that puts off the alarm in your head, right?
Exactly, yeah. I think the issue of whether the government should even fund science is a fraught one for sure, and the fact that they do does cause a lot of problems, but it was the fact that he was choosing to cut off this one because of a religious agenda.
Right, right. Now, when you tackle this hot-button issue in your very first novel, that could be kind of a risky thing. I mean, is your goal to make political points or philosophical points to your readers?
I think, first of all, as a novelist, my job is to entertain my readers. So that's first of mine. And second of all, I did want to create something thought-provoking. So a story with a brain, not just an action thriller with, you know, macho good guys and bad guys and explosions and stuff like that. I wanted to create a storyline that would make people consider our society today and what may be problems inherent in it and what we might be able to do to prevent a scenario like the one in my book from actually happening.
Okay.
That's a great answer.
Now, some people would say we've got Obama in office right now. He's lifted some of the restrictions on stem cell research. So maybe your topic's completely out of date and nobody cares about it. What do you think?
Yeah, I've been told that before, and actually I find it really funny when people say that. It's such a short-sighted thing to say because, as you know, the tide in politics turns daily. So the fact that maybe one president is more favorable than another really has no meaning. And when you look at our long-term future as a country, I mean, it's very plausible that we may elect a Republican in this election and then everything could change back. And when you're looking at a field that needs many, many years to grow over time in order to be applicable to medicine, you can't just look at the next election term or the next cycle. And I just want to also point out another thing. People have not only mentioned to me, oh, well, because Obama's in office, it's no longer relevant. They've also brought up the scientific issue that happened several years ago in 2009 when I was writing the book, or was it maybe 2008? Big news broke that scientists had been able to replicate embryonic stem cell-like cells based on skin cells. So they avoided the whole controversy of destroying an embryo, and everybody at the time said to me, oh, well, that's too bad for your book. Now nobody's going to care about embryonic stem cell research. And I was a little upset at the time. I mean, not because it would – I, of course, want the best possible science to get out there, whether it involves embryos or not. That's not my concern, but I did want my book to remain relevant. And I had a feeling that this science still would be. I mean, you can't just throw out one field – when another one seems promising, you should use all avenues possible. And then I was interested to find out recently, just last year actually, that those new cells that they had discovered actually had a lot of problems that they hadn't anticipated. And so everybody said at the time last year, oh, well, we still need to use embryonic stem cell research. That's really the best way we know. So,
well, and sure, And even though they say, okay, well, we can create from skin cells the type of stem cells that we need to do the types of research we're thinking about now, who knows what sorts of things would be possible with only the embryonic stem cells in the future. So that seems kind of nuts. And, you know, in terms of your political point, yeah, Santorum is exactly what I was thinking of. I've got somebody in the chat room here who brought up Santorum's candidacy. And this gives a clear indication that this issue is very much still relevant. I mean, we've got Republicans debating in their debates about, does life begin at conception? Does it begin even before conception? Some of them are, you know, really, really getting nitpicky about this, and I could see the type of situation in your book coming to life under some of these candidates, particularly Santorum.
Oh, yeah. I mean, a whole slew of them. In fact, didn't Santorum say just last week that he didn't believe in the separation of church and state?
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
Yes.
And then also Newt Gingrich said about a month ago or a month and a half ago that he would favor a commission to look at the ethics of how we manage fertility clinics, just straight out of my book.
Yeah, that's all we need is a government commission supervising fertility clinics, because it's not stressful enough for, you know, women going to fertility clinics and stuff. They've got to have the government involved in it as well. So in essence, there's some elements out there where things in your book are starting to come true.
Yeah, and in my book, for readers that have already gotten a chance to take a look at it, there are scenes where inspectors show up at fertility clinics and the women are waiting there, and it's very disquieting for everybody involved. So it's not far off,
right,
necessarily.
Now, there's something that you've discussed in the past and you get asked every single time because of your name and because of who your father is, and that is the influence that Ayn Rand and her ideas have had on your writing. Do you want to talk a little about that?
Sure. I think she has had an influence on me because I was brought up with these ideas. So I am in favor of a pro-reason stance and a hands-off government. And it's not just because I was raised with these ideas, I'd like to stress. I mean, however much people want to, if they agree or not, I would like to emphasize as much as I can that I really thought about these issues on my own, independent of my parents. And especially when I went away to college, I spent some time reading her books and reading Atlas Shrugged for the first time when I was away from my parents' influence. And I came to these conclusions on my own that I did agree with this philosophy and this political philosophy. And so you can see that at work in my novel, but I definitely wasn't trying to take anything from her stylistically or anything from her stories. I feel like this story really came organically to me based on my passions and my experience, and I don't think the storyline has anything to do with her or was influenced by her.
Now, and your parents didn't really push their ideas on you very much at all, right?
No, and that's part of the philosophy, obviously, is to let people decide for themselves and not have any kind of, forcing of ideas on somebody else. So, like, for example, when my dad gave me the Fountainhead to read when I think I was almost 17, I remember his inscription, and it said, "Judge this book as Howard Rourke would do," which is meaning on your own, without anyone else's thought.
Excellent. Yeah, excellent. And I think that was such a good approach for you. I mean, otherwise, way too much pressure. And especially being named Kira, which I've seen you write about as well, that can cause a lot of pressure. Now, I want to let people know that they can call in and ask Kira a question as well. The phone number is 760-888-5817. That's 760-888-5817. I've got a couple more questions here of my own for you. I've got one actually that was written in. Now, Living Proof portrays a dystopia that shows the evils of the theocratic right. I mean, as objectivists would see it, right? The potential evils of the theocratic right, at least, that we've seen maybe coming true. Do you have plans to also write any novels that show the problems with the left and socialism, as Rand did as well? Or, I mean, obviously you have to be inspired to do whatever it is, so it's not like you can say, okay, now I have to write something against the left. But do you have any interest in a topic along those lines?
I think I am interested in the topic of government infringement on our rights. So whether you want to call that right wing or left wing, it's pretty much coming from both sides. So however you want to classify that, I think that issue will crop up in my future stories, whether it's dealing with science again or dealing with free speech, which is a matter that I am very interested in. So, yeah, watch for that in my future books.
And as far as your future books go, I know you're working on your next novel. Are you able to say anything about it at all, or how long it is going to be until it comes out?
I'm not able to say when it's going to come out right now. It's in early stages still. I'm about a third of the way through it, and I can just give you a brief teaser of it, which is that it's also a novel of suspense dealing with a science medical topic. And it's the issue of aging. Can we defeat aging?
Okay. So, again, sort of a science-related issue.
Yeah, but it's going to be thrust into a wider context, and it's actually a pretty big story as I envision it. I think this is going to be the start of a trilogy.
Excellent.
Wow. Okay, that should be really exciting. And just to tell you, I read your book, and I really, really enjoyed it. And it held me, and as I've told you already, you know, separately at the end, the emotion really got to me. So really, really good job for your first time out, Kira. I mean, I was very, very impressed. And people that I have seen, friends of mine that I've talked to, have also been really impressed. I've had a few friends that have already finished it. And I just wanted to say kudos to you. And maybe ask, do you have any advice for people who are out there trying to write their novel? Is there any kind of system that you got into to make everything click for you and make you more productive as a writer? Any kind of advice that you can give?
That would be probably a whole other hour-long conversation. But first of all, thank you so much for the praise. It really means a lot to me. I've put everything into this book for the last 4 or 5 years. So to finally have people reading it and getting readers' reactions is thrilling for me, and each person that writes in and says that they enjoy it totally makes my day. So I'm really happy to hear that.
Excellent.
But as far as advice for other authors, this process of writing and publishing a book is so daunting and so overwhelming that it takes an unbelievable amount of persistence and thick skin. So I would say to anyone out there who's interested in doing this, make sure that you're ready for that, and just keep it up, because you're going to get a lot of no's. I certainly did. And there were a lot of times I wanted to quit, and I just couldn't quit. I felt like it would be too much of a betrayal of myself. So if you can stomach it, it'll be worth it in the long run. And if you have a good story to be told, do everything you can to enhance your knowledge of the craft, whether that's reading books on writing, like Stephen King's book on writing is really good, or taking writing workshops and finding peers and mentors. That's really, really helpful too. So first focus on writing the best story you possibly can, and then worry about the publishing part.
Right, right. And in terms of writing, do you write daily? Do you have certain days of the week? How does that work for you?
When I'm in my groove of writing, which is not now because I'm full on concentrating on this one now, but when I go back to writing, I like to write Monday through Friday for 5 to 6 hours each day, and I keep to a schedule pretty regularly every single day. I like routine, and I like to accomplish a certain amount every day, whether it's a number of hours or a number of words, depending on where I am in the process. So if I'm early on, I'd like to do at least 5 to 6 hours. If I'm, you know, getting into the writing already, I'd like to do 1,000 words a day, which I don't always reach. Sometimes I even go over. That's rare. But that's a goal that I've heard a lot of other writers also use. So for what it's worth, it's about 3 pages a day.
About 3 pages. Okay. I think we've got a caller here who wants to ask you a question. Let me see if I can take him and still be talking to you at the same time.
Sure.
Hello, who's this?
Hello, Amy. Hi, it's Robert.
Hi, Robert. So do you have a question for Kira Peekoff?
Yes, actually, I have first some feedback on the book, which I liked very much. Kira, you definitely captured the pace and the essence of New York City in the book.
Thank you.
And Bosch and Amy know that very few people in life know and love New York as much as I do. So kudos on that. Specifically, you have people schlepping uptown, and you have the Barnes & Nobles on 66th and Broadway, which unfortunately is no longer there. But
I know. Great loss.
Yeah. I liked your there's one quote you had, which I don't know if you did get from Ayn Rand, at least from her Spanish proverb, where the heroine says, "I took what I wanted, and I'm paying for it," which is, mm-hmm. I liked your twist on religious proverb, but I liked how you blended the religious and the secular. Mm-hmm. I grew up Catholic, so I knew a lot of these issues firsthand. Fortunately, my family's not as primitive as characters in the book, but also a couple of other brief things. I forgot how much I liked Grieg's first piano concerto. Thanks for reminding me of that. I played that while I was finishing up the book, and just at the very end, one of the characters, and this is actually my question. One of the characters is referred to.
Can we say spoiler alert?
Yeah. Do we need a spoiler alert here or no?
No, it's not. No, I'm not naming. I'm not naming. I'm just. No, I'm not on purpose. I want people to enjoy the book without anything that I'm going to say. It's just that they are referred to both as a genius and as human, and the way you set it up, human. The way I look at it is heroic, which there are definite heroes in the book, but it's a little bit mixed in the sense that they have some emotional elements and there are some obviously rational elements. So my question is, how conscious of were you of using that term and having it have that connotation?
It's a good question. I think I was conscious of the divide that you're talking about when I wrote that, and I think a lot of people consider the term genius to mean somebody that's just toiling away with a brilliant mind and no real relation or feeling for life or for other people or for their own sense of passion outside of their work. And by using the term human to counteract that, I wanted to get across that this character was a full person. He wasn't just his work. He had love in him too. And I don't think people think of having love when you think of a genius. So that's what I wanted to convey with those terms.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well done. That's what I got out of it. So Congratulations again.
Thank you.
All right. Any follow-up? That's it? Okay. Thanks very much, Robert. We've got one more question here in the chat room, Kira, and it is, are there any plans to make Living Proof into a movie?
Not as of yet. I have a feeling that Hollywood is gun-shy about this book because of the really politically slanted issue involved, and I've been wary. I haven't been waiting a book deal because I think that their sponsors would probably not like it. So, well, I'll let you know if anything happens, though.
Okay. Okay. And then we can announce it here as an exclusive release. No.
Yeah.
Where do you go from here in terms of promoting the book? Are there some events that you want to tell the listeners about where they can look out for you?
Yeah, definitely. I'm heading out to L.A. this week. I'll be in Hollywood at Book Soup on Wednesday night. I'll be in San Diego on Thursday and in Orange County at two different bookstores on Friday and Saturday. And you can see the complete schedule of my tour on my website, which is just kirapeacock.com. I'll mm-hmm. also be going to San Francisco, Philadelphia, Houston, and Austin for this leg of my trip. And then a week or two down the line, I'll be in Albany, West Hartford, Connecticut, Burlington, Massachusetts, and Holmdel, New Jersey.
So you did say you will be in San Francisco, that's right?
Yeah. Yes, I will be in San Francisco a week from tomorrow.
Excellent, excellent. And so they go to your website again, that's kirapeacock.com?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us. I think we've got all... Bosch, do you have any question for Kira?
Well, I haven't read the book yet. I'm sorry. I've been busy with my own comic book work, but I just want to say congratulations. I want to hear from
Thank
Amy.
You.
I'm really looking forward to reading it.
Yeah.
Oh, great. And...
Yeah. Everyone that I've seen who's read it has really enjoyed it so far, Kira. So this is
an exciting time for you.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
A fabulous accomplishment. And the one thing that I did want to add was that, yes, there are ideas in this book, but I never felt like you were hitting people over the head with the ideas. And so I think you really struck the right balance of integrating ideas as inextricably part of an exciting plot. And
that was the goal.
Very, very good job. So go on with your next appointment. Thank you very much for taking this time out with us, Kira. And I look forward to seeing you at one of the signing events and getting my copy signed.
Wonderful. I look forward to it and hope to see some listeners there as well.
Okay, great. Again, that's kirapeacock.com. Take care, Kira. Okay, so that was Kira Peekoff. I've got other people in the chat room saying I read the book this week and it was great. That was Rosemary in the chat room. Chicago asked Joe, and I didn't hear her say Chicago. But again, go to her website at kirapeekoff.com and you can keep up with all of the happenings there, the tour and everything like that. Unfortunately, she could stay with us for only a short time, but I think we got a lot of ground covered in that period of time as well.
Some great answers from her.
So that was good. So we're going to go ahead and switch gears now to some of our political fare, which is not quite as happy as it is talking to an author who just accomplished the release of a really good first novel.
It must be amazing. I mean, also when she got her books, I mean, I know when I got my first book,
the boxes
come, you crack it open, you smell that fresh book smell. There's nothing like it. I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah. So this is really good. So the first thing I was going to talk about is today I'm looking at the wallstreetjournal.com trying to get back into the swing of talk show. As you know, last week I left you guys in the lurch because my voice is still not 100%. I apologize for it, by the way. But I've been just killed with this sinus infection. And so I'm browsing wallstreetjournal.com. I'm looking for different news stories. I already had some ideas of some things we needed to talk about. But I see this ad. And the ad says there's a high-yield savings account that they're advertising. And the interest rate, they display this interest rate proudly in a huge font. And what is the interest rate on a high-yield savings account these days? And I asked Bosch to guess it earlier.
Yeah.
And what did you guess?
I guess something ridiculous.
Like a few percent or something at least, right? 0.75% is described as a high-yield interest rate, and they are proud to put that out there. They're going to attract your money by offering you 0.75%.
This is a deal.
Yeah, this is great. So I asked myself, what kind of world do we live in where a high yield account pays less than 1%?
Right.
And really, there's a couple things going on. We have a government through the Fed holding rates artificially low. And I just finished watching earlier today the latest Alan Barton front page where you've got
Terry Jones
and Yaron Brook talking, and they're talking about the Fed because Ron Paul was testifying, I guess, in Congress this week, or questioning Ben Bernanke, who was testifying in Congress. And he was holding up an ounce of silver, and he said, well, I forget how many years ago, this silver would buy 4 gallons of gasoline, and now it buys over 11. And so he's saying basically it's only silver that's holding value. Silver is a store of value, and our money's worthless. Apparently, the Fed plans, and it has announced that it plans to hold interest rates at zero through 2014.
And what did Ron Paul?
And it's like regardless of what's going out there in the real world with the market and everything like that.
They want to dictate. I mean, that's the thing also.
So their whole...
Because they rule the world. I mean, you know that, right?
Well, I mean, they want to make everything look good, I think, for the politicians in office, too. Oh, yeah. That's part of their thing. So they're holding these rates artificially low, supposedly to stimulate the economy. It's going to get the economy going. But at the
Nothing they've done has stimulated the economy.
Yeah, but at the same time, you would say, okay, if the economy was truly being stimulated, if people were out there saying, okay, I'm going to be an entrepreneur, I'm going to launch a new productive endeavor, I'm going to open the restaurant I always wanted to, the new training facility I always wanted to do, I'm going to find new ways to leverage money, whatever it is, you'd think, okay, well, these people are going to borrow money in order to do it, right? Because they have an idea that's going to make profit. But what this 0.75% high yield rate tells you is that all the other things that the government is doing, in addition to holding rates artificially low, all the interventions, the regulations, the prohibitions, they don't let you drill oil certain places, all this stuff, everything it's doing is making it so that no one thinks that they can actually borrow your money and make a big enough profit to pay you a decent interest rate. Right? Because if they thought they could make money at a decent rate, they would gladly borrow at higher than 0.75%, and then they'd pay your interest rate on the borrowed money and still take home a nice profit. But obviously, if this is out there, that means just nobody is making any money. And this is even more disturbing if you think of what the real rate of inflation is right now. And this is something else that Yaron Brook and Terry Jones discussed on Front Page. And I'm no financial expert, but I try to retain everything that I can pick up from these two guys because they know what they're talking. Are you a financial expert?
Well, I'm going to keep mum.
Okay.
I'm going to let you speak.
The Consumer Price Index. The Consumer Price Index. What I gleaned from their appearance on Alan Barton's Front Page this week was that the Consumer Price Index, stupidly, does not include food and gas.
Why?
So that they can pretend that inflation isn't as bad as it is. I mean, that's the only thing I can think of.
Absolutely. So it's something corrupt.
So if you actually put food and gas back into the mix, we have a real inflation rate of 8%.
Things that make us go, things that make cars go. You know.
Yeah. So you put your money in the bank at your so-called high-yield savings account, and next year it's worth basically almost, 7% less at least, right, than it was the year before. It's going to buy 7% less if you look at the real rate of inflation. So this is just abhorrent. It is disgusting. And there was a quote that went out through the Ayn Rand bot today that I thought was appropriate. And she said, paper money is a mortgage on wealth that does not exist, backed by a gun aimed at those who are expected to produce it. End quote.
You saw that on the Rambot?
It was on the Rambot out there today. And I mean, just how appropriate, because here we have this paper money, not backed by any silver, gold, any sort of hard
Nothing
bullion.
Solid.
And it's worthless. And, if somebody has a fixed income on retirement.
Very simple and very true.
What is David saying here?
No, you cannot believe any numbers issued by the government. I mean, zero. That's just, they are lying rats in general.
Well, luckily, we still have people in the private sector, like Terry Jones at Investors Business Daily, who crank out actual estimates of what's going on. Or you'll see the stories whenever there's a holiday. For instance, I remember them saying at Thanksgiving that a Thanksgiving meal in 2011 cost 13 or 14% more than it did in 2010.
And then maybe the one honest politician would say it, but I forgot his name. You?
What honest politician is that? I don't know.
I don't know.
So we're in a real bad way, and one of the huge, huge looming government interventions into the economy, one that hasn't even taken hold yet. Okay, so we're telling you how bad the picture is right now. We've got real inflation at 8%. Your savings will only yield in a high yield savings account 0.75%. I mean, I'm sure there's other rates, and people are posting different rates in the chat room here, but you know, this is, I assume, representative. Your money is becoming worthless, and yet the huge Obamacare, which is a big regulation of 1/6 of the economy, I guess, is the healthcare industry.
That's right.
It hasn't even come fully into effect yet, right?
To do its damage.
And this is one of the supposedly huge issues in the election with the candidates. We have a story that breaks this week about Romney, Mitt Romney, and his true position on the individual mandate of Obamacare. And again, Obamacare as a piece of legislation is more than just about the individual mandate. A lot of people have focused on the evil of the individual mandate because I think it's the one that people can clearly see is most likely unconstitutional, even on today's interpretation of what constitutional powers are.
And that's the government's ultimate hook, though.
But that's
the ultimate hook into the system where we are all locked
in. And I think the mandate is the thing that's supposed to supposedly pay for the rest of it, right?
Yeah.
It was the bargaining chip that they use with the insurance industry. They say, yes, insurance industry, we're going to put certain mandates on you that you cannot deny people insurance for pre-existing conditions. You have to keep them until they're 25. Blah, 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 these different mandates. And the only way they get it is by the mandate. Yeah.
And this sort of shows why Romney is a lying sack of mitt, as I wrote on my blog this week.
Yeah. So what happens is all through the campaign, Mitt Romney has stood in front of us in these debates and he has said, oh, well, I'm not really for the individual mandate, even of Romney Care, for the entire country. It worked great for Massachusetts, it might work great for some states. I'm really a 10th Amendment guy where I think that the state should be able to decide whether to have socialized medicine, which is a problem in and of itself, right? But, you know, he says, I'm not for it at the national level. So then this week, and I've got an article here by Andrew C. McCarthy writing for The Corner at National Review Online. Andrew C. McCarthy just ends up writing a lot of good stuff, so I end up using his stuff on the show here a lot. But the original break of the news story was from someone named Andrew Kaczynski over at BuzzFeed. And there was a 2009 op-ed written by Mitt Romney for USA Today in which Romney encouraged Obama that he would be well served by adopting various elements of the Massachusetts Romney Care Plan. And, McCarthy points out here, particularly the individual mandate. Yeah. And here's the quote from Romney. Romney says, quote, we established incentives for those who were uninsured to buy insurance. Now, what do those incentives consist of? Here we go. Using tax penalties as we did, or tax credits as others have proposed, encourages free riders to take responsibility for themselves rather than pass their medical costs on to others. End quote.
I think Romney was envious that Obama beat him to it. I think that's what it was. And he said, I always thought about this. I mean, I was the first one. You know, I was the first one to pass it. I mean, what a.
I mean, this is.
You were going to say a point.
No, and this is so loaded, right?
Yeah.
Because the assumption here is that there can be such thing as a free rider. And the only reason that there can be such thing as the free rider is because in many states, and probably there's some elements of federal law involved here too, they are forced to provide so-called free care for people who come into an emergency room,
right.
whether or not they have insurance, means to pay.
Whether or not it is an emergency.
Right. Whether it's really an emergency.
Yeah.
I've heard story after story of people just going
to the
emergency room in order to get care that they can't pay for otherwise. And it's just routine types of stuff that they have no business going to an emergency room for. So, yeah, I guess if you take the premise that the government is going to mandate that these hospitals provide care to people without insurance, then you have a so-called free rider problem. But nobody even considers the idea of removing that mandate
right.
and saying, look, it's an issue of private charity. If you don't have insurance, you go to the charity hospital. Or you sit there and say, I'm a charity case, would you please take care of me? As it is now, the government mandates that they take care of these people. So what McCarthy points out, he says the op-ed that he wrote demonstrates that Mitt regarded Romney Care precisely as a model that the federal government ought to adopt, and that the tax penalties by which the individual mandate are enforced were a good fit for Congress and the Obama administration to impose by federal law.
And you figure if McCarthy found this, that his opponents would have found it, but, you know, they just, whatever reason, they haven't brought it up.
Yeah, why haven't Romney's opponents followed this? Now, and McCarthy goes on in this piece, and I recommend you could take a look at it. He's quite good. He says, nowhere does the op-ed suggest that government involvement is the principal cause
right.
of inflation.
Right.
And that maybe prices would come down if people paid all their ordinary health expenses out of pocket and had insurance purchased in a truly free market for catastrophes and other high expenses.
What does it say about Romney?
Et cetera.
That, you know, that just says that he's a big government politician, lifelong politician,
right.
who you know, wants to use government to whatever.
Right, and he was not being straight with us. Now, I went and actually looked at the piece by Romney, and I found it at a website. And I don't know if Romney's people run this, but it seems like a URL that would be run by Romney's people.
It was for USA Today, I believe, originally.
Well, right.
So, yeah.
But the website on which I found it republished is MittRomneyCentral.com. So it seems that somebody who's in favor of Mitt Romney was proud enough of the piece to have posted it there.
But did they post it then as well? Or it's not posted recently because he would not want this out there.
No, I don't think he would post it recently, but it was
yeah.
dug up, like we said, by Andrew Kaczynski at BuzzFeed. But here's some little bits of clues here about Romney's attitude towards government involvement in the healthcare industry. If you take a look at the piece, this is dated from July 30th of 2009. And the title is "Mr. President, What's the Rush?" And he points out he points out Obama's frantic approach as being a problem. So it's okay if you socialize it slowly.
Let's do it eventually.
But yeah.
Which is why, again, he's a socialist. He's not a socialist. He's a socialist.
Yeah, it's doing it frantically that's the problem. He says,
unbelievable.
And then he says, for the sake of 47 million uninsured Americans, we need to get our healthcare system back on track. So this is the very first line of the piece. So at the very beginning, he's saying we have to do something for the sake of 47 million uninsured Americans. So the altruist idea, the idea that it is our duty to sacrifice our interests it's the given. I mean, we have to do this, right? So then he says one of the problems is that there's special favors thrown into it. It's rushed through on an artificial deadline. And he says, I, on the other hand, in Massachusetts, I worked in a bipartisan fashion. When I finished my legislation, there were only two dissenting votes. And then he says, oh, you know, our citizens purchase private free market medical insurance. He says, federal government insurance company isn't even necessary, which is crazy because, you know, first of all, like I said, other provisions of Obamacare and the other one that we talked about before in this show, there is a mandate in Obamacare that I think has already started to take effect that tells insurance companies what percentage of their budget they can spend on actual healthcare disbursements versus marketing,
jeez,
bureaucracy, infrastructure, whatever, you know, their other costs are. If they're telling them what percentage that they can spend on these things, they're doing it in a way that's probably not going to make them profitable.
And
they're going to drive them out of business. So, yeah, federal government insurance is going to be necessary under Obamacare.
And Romney is impotent against Obamacare in the debates. I mean, absolutely impotent. And they know that. And so for them, it's perfect. You know, they got him on that.
So he goes on in this piece. He starts talking about, you know, the tax penalties and the tax credits. And he brags, he says, that this doesn't cost the government a single dollar.
Oh, man.
So his standard is whether the government is cost money, not whether you are forced to pay money, whether you have to pay money out of pocket, as long as it doesn't cost the government a single
dollar. And he's part of the government, so he's not losing money.
Yeah.
As far as he's concerned.
And, you know, and then he says the federal government sends an estimated $42 billion to hospitals that care for the poor. Use those funds instead to help the poor buy private insurance, as we did. So the assumption is you're going to spend $42 billion.
We have that money anyway.
You're going to spend
it. We got that
money. So it's spend it one way versus the other way, you know?
And my way is better than his way.
And then, you know, he touts, he says, the Massachusetts...
We will blow your money better than they blow your money.
Yeah, we have a better way to spend your money. The Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation concluded that our program's cost is relatively modest and well within initial projections. And then he says, you know, 98% of our citizens are insured. Of course, in a different part of the article, he brags. He says, this Republican is proud to be the first governor to ensure that all this... Ugh. You know, state citizens are insured, but no, it was only 98%. Then he talks about so-called healthcare inflation. And in this piece that he's writing as advice to Obama, he says, well, you know, in Massachusetts, I couldn't do anything about healthcare costs. He says, but at the federal level, you can take steps to stop or slow medical inflation. Now, how is it that you stop or slow medical inflation? Now, the real way to do it is to get government out of healthcare.
Get the hell out of here.
Right? But
and he never clearly...
No. Getting government out of healthcare, no.
That's a given. Government is part of your life, and you're going to have to deal with it.
Right.
Even
right.
At me, the small government Republican, allegedly.
No. What he says, we have an incentive problem. He says, we need to change incentives. He says, we might do what some countries have done, require patients to pay a portion of their bill, except for certain conditions. Well, at least that would be something that would at least get closer to a free market. But then he says, and providers could be paid an annual fixed fee for the primary care of an individual and a separate fixed fee for the treatment of a specific condition. Now, if you have a provider, healthcare provider, who is paid an annual fixed fee to care for you, the incentive is then he provides you as little care as possible so he can take home as much of that money as possible, because each amount of care that he provides for you, each hour he spends with you, is less money in his pocket, comparatively speaking, because he gets a fixed fee whether he sees you all year or not, right?
It's locked in, yeah.
So what kind of incentives are that? And also, who gets to decide, you know, what it is that the patients are going to pay for versus, you know, what specific conditions and all these things? Of course, government's going to do it from a top-down approach. And then he goes on to talk about, and this is something that Mitt Romney always does, he says, I am from the private sector. And
I
will tackle this problem.
Like, I'm not a politician. I'm not Washington.
I'll tackle this problem like a businessman.
Yeah,
and, you know, we'll look at the different resources and we'll allocate them the most of it. It's like, look, the government is not a business. And when you supposedly say you're running a government like a business, you're still engaging in top-down planning. You are engaging in government planning. And everybody knows government planning doesn't work. We need a free market.
And they think money is coming in. Our tax money is their business money that they can do with as they please.
It's just resources for them to use. Now, what do we got here? We've got Martin coming up with some more puns. He said, slothshalist. I can't even pronounce that one. Can you pronounce that one?
Slothshalist.
So maybe he's that. We also do have a caller that we're going to let chime in on this as well. Mitt is in the dictionary's margin definition for duplicitous.
at least someone liked my pun.
Lying sack of Mitt. Excellent. Who are these honest politicians anymore? I don't know.
He's a very complex individual, though, Mitt Romney. He's a Republican, Democrat, liberal, conservative. You know what I mean? I mean,
he's got all these characteristics. I mean, you know, there's so many problems with this. First of all, dishonest.
Lying sack.
Dishonest.
Fundamentally.
You're considering who to nominate for president.
And you got a lying rat against a lying rat. That's perfect.
So, and the other thing that happened, I can't even believe this. So this story is broken, and Eric Cantor endorsed Romney. Do you know that?
Oh, man.
Eric Cantor endorsed
Romney.
Eric can't
do anything.
This is a Wall Street Journal story from today. It says House Majority Leader Eric Cantor endorsed Mitt Romney for president, saying that the former Massachusetts governor is best suited to address voters' concerns about the economy.
It's unbelievable.
He's
impotent. He's another one.
He says this candidate's best able to lead the economy back to a growth mode.
To lead the economy, government?
Create jobs so people can feel better about the future.
A politician leading the economy, a politician. He doesn't get it.
No,
he's a fan of Atlas Shrugged. Supposedly, actually, he is. I think he was on the other side, though. I mean, you know, he said, that looks like me.
Let me see what our caller here would like to say about this. What do you have to say about Mitt Romney? Who is this? Hi.
Hi, Amy. It's Debbie.
Hi, hey, Debbie. So, are you thrilled with our choices of candidates here?
Oh boy, no. I mean, I was just so sad on Tuesday night because I found myself cheering for Romney to beat Santorum in Michigan.
Yeah,
right.
Then I got what I wanted, and then I felt disappointed at the same time. Like, oh God, this was the best outcome.
Right, but that Santorum, he's so bad that he makes you think that. I mean, he's just so bad.
Yeah, I mean, now I think Santorum, and I think Kira's novel.
Yep.
Yeah. And not just Kira's novel, because Santorum, it's not that he's great on all these economic issues and just bad on social issues.
Yeah.
He's bad on the economic
spending,
issues as
government.
Well. I mean, he's just as much a big government politician.
Also, sorry, I tweeted something this week which is pretty popular, pretty much retweeted. It was I'm for the separation of Santorum and state. You
know? Yeah. Yeah. We want the separation of Santorum and state. But the problem is we also want the separation of Romney and
absolutely.
State and Gingrich and state.
Obama and state.
Obama and state. I don't know what we're gonna do, but this, I mean, what do you think of this?
Someone writes, Joe Andrews, Romney's the creme de la crepe. That's a good one, sorry.
That is a pretty good one. People who aren't in the chat room probably should get in the chat room because there are a number of
good
jokes
stuff.
In the chat room that we can't even get to during the live broadcast here. But so what do you think, Deborah? I mean, I'm seeing him. He's dishonest. And this idea of voting for somebody to be the nominee when he's been shown to be dishonest about his positions? Or do you think that he can finesse this one and say, oh, well, I was just giving him advice
what? Even 2002, he referred to himself as a progressive. I mean, this is who we're dealing with here. And this is who we're dealing with here. We're dealing with an absolute leftist Democrat who's trying to hide out in the Republican Party. And that's what he is.
So what do you think, Deborah?
Well, I think Romney can say pretty much everything, and he has. But, you know, I also wanted to share with you guys some more bad stuff about him if you're interested. You know I don't understand why people say that he would be good for economic issues or that somehow he's a fiscal conservative because I see no evidence of it.
No.
And I heard some quotes on Mark Levin, and I found them on the internet, too, of Romney talking about his Olympics. He turned around the Olympics. That's like the one example people use all the time of how he's so good with money and stuff. But there's all these quotes of him bragging about how he got millions of dollars from the government. Like he says, I'm a big believer in getting money where the money is. The money's in Washington.
Right.
I've learned from my Olympic experience that you have people who really understand how Washington works and have personal associations there. You can get money to help build economic development opportunities.
It was so ugly. It was so ugly, and he was so like happy about it. He was almost giddy. And,
he was boastful.
You know, he's like, I got some government goodies for you. Don't worry about it, and I know where to go. I mean, it's just wow.
All these politicians, and you know, their idea is. It is their money to spend. The whole economy is their playground or something. Now, Batten in the chat room has a joke that we're going to have to tell to everybody, so we're going to interrupt you here for a second. He says, a conservative and a liberal walks into a bar, and the bartender says, hi, Mitt.
That's pretty good. I like that.
So people in the chat room are saying in the November election it's going to be pick your poison. I mean, the way I always talk about it is I feel like when we're asked to choose a candidate, we are asked to decide which part of our body we want to have cut off.
Right. I mean, look, he's not proven to be as absolutely destructive as Obama yet. That's the only thing you have going for him, you know, Mitt Romney. Well, you know, he doesn't have full power yet.
No, I mean, this is
he's not a nihilist.
This is the only thing that I think we can have going for Mitt Romney right now is that for some reason he has decided that he wants to be elected as a Republican.
Yeah.
And he knows in his mind that being elected as a Republican means he has to promise and maybe carry out some things having to do with moving a little bit closer towards a free market. And so that maybe he could be counted on to do some of those things, at least in his first term, because he'd like to get reelected for a second term.
We might be able to survive as a country, maybe.
But I mean, he's going to go after China, which means all the stuff at Walmart is going to get way more expensive. And
no, he goes after
I'm hating the hit that my wallet is having, you know, the hit to my wallet on a weekly basis right now.
Oh yeah, food, even everything.
Gas.
Well,
gas
is. I mean, if he would even just do some real mealy mouth stuff to stop making gas more expensive, you know, I mean, he's not hell bent on destroying the country. He doesn't
That's
seem to burn with rage and hatred for the United States.
He wants power, and Obama wants destruction. I mean, Obama wants to use that power to destroy us. It doesn't matter what he constantly believes or what that's what he's doing.
Yeah.
And Mitt probably wouldn't do that.
He wants political power, and he wants political power as a Republican, which is supposed to mean certain things.
And they're clear. He made a choice at a certain point. I guess I'll choose to be a Republican at this time because whatever. Who knows? Because Massachusetts was too busy with Democrats. He didn't want to, you know what I mean? He wanted to be a contrarian. I mean, I don't know. At least by, you know, an R instead of a D.
Yeah, people are talking about the food and gas is going are up. Food and gas prices are going up, but they're not part of the CPI. Yeah, that's the whole point. The CPI, I don't even know if it's even a useful indicator of anything because food and gas are huge elements of our monthly budget, and it's where it hits us in the pocketbook. So I don't even care about the consumer price index. I care about what happens to me with my monthly budget. I care more about measures like the Thanksgiving meal costing 13% more one year from the last year. But I mean, you know, we've got all of these candidates completely steeped in the altruist premise that it is the government's job to make sure that we are all doing our duty and helping out our fellow man to the appropriate extent. And they say things like, I mean, I've heard Mitt Romney say this during a debate. He says, well, if I'm going to spend our precious dollars, you know. And it's just he's got a bunch of big pot of money, and he's going to spend it better than Obama spends it.
And he knows where the money is.
You know, he said it sounds, you know, they all talk a good game. It's, you know, when Newt Gingrich talks, he says, well, if I'm going to have people on welfare, I'm going to make them get some job training while they're on welfare.
Right.
It's like, well, we're still spending a bunch of money on them, even though it sounds better because we're actually making them, you know, do something, supposedly jump through a hoop to get the money. When Mitt Romney says, well, we don't want to have all those free riders out there, do they? I mean, that sounds great if you don't know the context.
We see about compassion. You know,
oh, yeah. Compassion is part of the GOP's identity.
Yeah.
So
we're
stuck in a big way. And I'm afraid that the longer that we have this big government and Obamacare is just going to exacerbate the problem, there's this entrenched entitlement mentality that people have, and it just kind of entrenches altruism structurally in people's minds because they
are part of our life in a way where we are forced.
Everybody acts as if altruism is true because they're being forced by the government to act as if it's true. And if they don't think, if they don't stop and think, does it have to be this way?
And
they would just blindly accept. Oh, they're, you know, the government's just doing
the good thing.
Mitt Romney
would not be an opponent of Obamacare. The only thing, the only change he would make is maybe change the name. You know, turn to Romneycare. I mean, he wouldn't be an opponent. He can't be an opponent, fundamentally, philosophically. It's possible.
Well, maybe if they put a repeal bill in front of him, he'll sign it, since he promised. I don't know how likely it is, but I know he's more likely to repeal it than Obama.
Sure.
So I'll
that's
still...
The only thing.
It's not anything to be excited about, but he'd be better than Obama.
Right. Now, do remember, though, that there were two things that he said. He said he does want to replace it with something.
Right.
And one of the words that he used in describing the thing with which he wants to replace Obamacare is mandate on an insurance company. So he does think that certain mandates on insurance companies are good. And, you know, the more mandates we put on the insurance companies, the more we drive them out of business, and the more that we have to move closer and closer to a single-payer system because there will be no private insurance companies in business anymore. So it's hopeless.
I mean, I don't know. We might have to end up voting for the American in this election ultimately. Ultimately.
Someone who says they're at least for America?
Yes. I mean, at least who says, you know, who you might believe it to an extent.
So who do you predict to come out the big winner on Super Tuesday? Deborah?
Well, for me, the best case scenario, and I say this with a lot of qualifications, would be Gingrich. I mean, I still think he'd be better than Mitt and certainly better than Santorum. I think that it sounds like, I mean, Santorum, if you look at the Real Clear Politics average, he's really tanked, which is good. And I guess we can console ourselves with the fact that it's Romney and not Santorum, for whatever that's worth.
Right.
So,
but then hopefully he can run for his money and just, I hope they just go at it hardcore.
And the reason that I would root for Gingrich is not necessarily, I mean, right now, you know how it is. The one that you look at is the one that you hate. So we haven't looked at Gingrich closely for a while, so we think he looks more attractive
at this moment.
If we looked at a few things that Gingrich said over the last week, we might hate him as well. But
Gingrich
has
said less hateful things. I think he said better things than the other guys about the big issues.
In the last 2 weeks.
Well, what I'm saying is he has said things, and he has held his ground against these things.
He has said some good things.
Which are good.
He's all over the map.
But I think he may believe some of those things.
But the reason that I hope he does well is to keep this race alive with that small hope that we'll have this broker convention and someone on a white stallion is going to ride in and save
Paul
us from
Ryan.
This.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, maybe it could happen, I guess.
He would be closer to the anti-Obama than the other guys, that's for sure. I mean, he would be.
Yeah.
Whatever problems we could have with him, he would be closer to that. And that's what we need. That's what we needed from day one. But the idiot GOP has not been able to actually muster up that kind of – and again, those who haven't run, who love the country allegedly, who think they could run next time, really, you got to question their patriotism. You have to.
Right.
Because this is the moment of truth here. And they have
They've let us down. Yeah. They've definitely let us down. Anything else on this topic, Deborah?
Nope.
Okay. Thanks very much for calling in, and feel free to call in if any of the other topics get your goat a little bit later, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Hi, we've got another caller on the line. Who's this?
It's Harold.
Hi, Harold. So what do you think about Romney's disingenuous about the Obamacare issue, the individual mandate? Not surprised, right?
Yeah, I told you so, kind of. that would be my comment. I'm looking at a potential brokered convention. I'm hoping, praying for one, if there's such a thing.
Right.
And there was Peter Schiff had a show. You know, he has a talk show, so he did a show on that, and he had one of the think tank people come in with, you know, all the statistics and whatever. But I'm looking at this, and I, once again, like what I said several weeks ago, I still think Newt can do fairly well in the South. And I'm hoping Santorum picks up Ohio just as a blocking move to stop Romney. And then if we get all of that, if you run through the numbers, if you go look online, you look at all the states, they're all pretty much proportional. And the ones that are winner-take-all are by congressional district. So that means even the losers can still pick up some delegates. So I see this thing going a long time. And the last thing I want to see is Romney on a roll early here. I'd like to see him blocked all the way to the end. New York is proportional. California is winner-take-all, but by congressional district. So I see California breaking down also with some votes for the losers. So my big fear is that California will put Romney over the top. That's the problem, but it comes late. So that's a good thing. I was trying to find some Senate races to get involved with. I did look online, and there's just a dearth of good candidates. It's just so bad.
Okay.
I saw some in Utah that kind of looked useful, and then when I went through the biographies, they were like ex Bain Capital people, and I thought, oh no, Bain Capital sounds like a politician breeding machine, you know.
Right.
So The one race that I'm really happy about is that Olympia Snow dropped out, and I found out why she dropped out. She was losing in the polling data in the primary against Scott Dambois. So he's
okay.
A Tea Party. He's Tea Party self-identified, Tea Party endorsed, but he's a conservative, so he's to the right on all the religious issues. But he's good on all the economics. But there's no libertarian or classical liberal. I guess I'm a classical liberal. In other words, strong on foreign policy, but otherwise a libertarian.
Right.
And there's no one like that. I looked at the political, you know, there's like a political map. I don't know if you've ever seen it. Personal liberty and then economic liberty, and they have a two-dimensional axis. I thought for us, we need a third dimension. We need a third page where you have national security, where you have a 3D type chart, you know, where you can
right.
be like a libertarian, and then you have an axis for national security, and you can move all the way to the right on that. So like a libertarian plus 100% on national security. And that's where I'd be. I'd be like in that corner right at the edge of the cube, you know, the Rubik's Cube.
You know, there was one candidate that a listener asked me to take a look at this week, and it wasn't for the Senate. It was someone who was running for Gabrielle Giffords' seat in Arizona in Congress. They're having a special
mm-hmm.
election out there. And
okay.
I don't know if you've heard of this woman. Her name is Martha McSally.
Okay. No, I haven't heard of her. The good thing is Arizona is not a religious state, so that would be good for us.
Yeah. Now, she is a conservative. I went and looked at all of you know, her stands on all the different issues. She seems to be very good on all the issues except for social issues. But all she says with respect to the issue of life, she just says, I believe in the sanctity of every human life. And it's just one sentence, and she doesn't have any particular policies that she is promoting or anything else. Every other issue practically on her issues page, if you go McSallyforCongress.com, she has long paragraphs, and she talks about the fact that we need to get government out of healthcare. Every concrete thing that she proposes with respect to healthcare, she talks about free market solutions, patient-centered reform, all
right.
of the keywords that you want to hear from these people. So maybe on the congressional level, we're going to see some better candidates. It seems to me that the Senate, for some reason, breeds people that are, you know, the more moderate Republicans to get somebody who's truly good Tea Party. Now, you know, here's the thing. If you do have somebody who is good on all the fiscal issues and good on defense and just bad on the social issues, you're still doing better than Santorum, because Santorum is terrible on social issues and he's good on defense, I would say.
Yes.
Probably he's pretty good on defense.
Yes.
I think there were some things that he said that weren't good
Stupid.
In terms of being friends
Pakistan.
With Pakistan.
He says,
being friends with Pakistan.
If Pakistan gets nukes, we have to be their friend. It's like, oh, sorry. If Iran, I think, basically said, I think we are friends with Pakistan because they have nukes. Something
right.
Stupid like
right.
that.
Right. He's terrible on fiscal issues. So if we have a number of candidates whose, you know, only failing is something on social issues, and as long as they don't make those social issues a priority,
they can believe what they want.
If she says, I believe in the sanctity of every human life, she doesn't say she's going to do anything about it politically, you know?
Whereas Santorum is against the separation of church
and state. I'm looking at the practicality of getting involved. And a state with a big population is a problem. There's too many calls to make. Whereas a place like Maine has got a tiny population. You get leverage. But Scott Dambois is going to make it on his own. He doesn't need any help. I'm almost certain he's going to win the primary. But then he's not suitable for the general election because he's pretty to the right on all the religious stuff. And in Maine would have been ideal for us because we could have gone liberal on all the social issues and yet gone hard on national security and economics. And I think that might have been a perfect mix. I was thinking of, what's his name again? He's one of your political experts. I said he didn't pronounce his R's properly. I forgot what his name is now.
Are you talking about Yaron Brook?
Yaron Brook, that's it. I was thinking Yaron would have been perfect to run in Maine. You know, but the trouble is the organization to set up and to get on the ballot, This other guy's already on the ballot. You know, you have to collect 14,000 signatures, and it's a big organizational
uphill. Well, and of course he'd have to move to Maine, which I don't think I would necessarily tell him, Yaron, you must move to Maine.
Well, temporarily until you go to Washington, D.C.
Right.
The main thing is in the middle of June, so there's plenty of time to actually influence the outcome there. But this guy really, he has a website with hardly anything on it. I'm hoping for a brokered convention and that Rand Paul or Marco Rubio becomes the guy. That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah, because you know he's more conservative. If you look at the political mapping, that 2D political mapping, I went through all the candidates and I looked at them, and they're either, if they're left, they are left liberal or an authoritarian, or they're centered and authoritarian. There's very few that are kind of further up on the liberty scale. There's a handful. Rand Paul is to the right but libertarian, unlike his father who's more liberal than him. So.
Okay.
For me, I would take Rand Paul as a compromise. I would live with that. You know, for me, that's acceptable.
Okay.
I don't know who else there is, but there is a dearth of good candidates right now. It's really a problem. I mean, it's not the money, it's not the organization, it's the people. And
yes.
I'm not sure how to find better people. Maybe we need a whole new education system.
Well, and that's the problem, because we have this big government-run education system, plus all of the other infrastructure of the big government that's conditioned everybody to say that this is just the way it is, we accept
right.
it. And I do think that it helps to institutionalize the altruist morality in people. They just can't imagine it any other way. I mean, you know, obviously the few can, but the few who do
right.
adhere to the ideas that we hold, can they even be elected by the mass of people or get the fundraising that they need or those types of things? I mean, we've seen Gary Johnson struggle. You know, Gary Johnson has struggled terribly.
Gary Johnson's, how can I say, his personality is just not that good. You get someone with a good personality and that has good points, you can sell just about anyone with a good calling campaign. And if you properly position yourself, you can. But you have to have a product to sell. The trouble is selling something that's no good. That's very hard to do.
Okay. Yeah. Definitely.
All right.
Well, thank you for your update
for your
on the political front. I don't know that we're any more optimistic about it, but you think so? Scott Danbois, he's going to win the nomination, but you think he's got no chance in the general election for the Senate in Maine?
Well, he beat out the Republican Party is very dirty at the when it comes to trying to get on the ballot. They'll do everything and every dirty trick there is to keep people off the ballot that they don't like, especially the Tea Party. The fact that he was able to get on the ballot and scare Olympia Snowe enough that she dropped out, that's a good sign.
Okay. Well, we'll see how his candidacy shapes up in the coming weeks too.
Yeah, the only one that I was hopeful for was Linda Lingle in Hawaii. And I had a look at her, and she's a centrist, unfortunately. But the person she's running against is going to be a far left liberal. So that still may be preferable. You know, sometimes you got to pick the least poisonous.
Right. And as people in the chat room are saying right now, the goal really is to buy us some time until a better group can be elected. That's Robert in the chat room right now is saying that.
Because Obama's the worst.
Yeah.
Nobody can be worse.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much. Now, we are a little bit past the hour already talking about politics, and I wanted to switch gears here a little bit and talk about Andrew Breitbart. We were shocked earlier this week to get the news that Andrew Breitbart, at the age of 43, which is quite young, suddenly just collapsed and passed away. They couldn't revive him, walking outside of his home in Los Angeles. And Andrew Breitbart, for people who don't know, he was the creator of all of the big sites, big Hollywood, big government,
big
peace. He also has Breitbart.tv.
Big journalism. Breitbart.com. And he worked with Drudge, Matt Drudge, on the Drudge Report years ago. In
right.
the 90s, yeah.
And he also worked for the Huffington Post.
Right. He set that up. Mm-hmm. And his reason was, as he put it, he wanted a good competitor. I mean, you can't help your enemy build house, but whatever. He gave his reasons for that.
Yeah. But generally, he built his reputation as an activist, a writer, a publisher, sort of a kind of a manager of all of these different various projects that were brainstorms of his. And notably, one of the things he did was take down Acorn, right?
Yeah. Anthony Weiner.
And others.
I mean,
yeah, exposed Anthony.
And another politician.
Increasingly
as well.
Exposed Anthony.
Another
Weiner.
Politician as well, someone else. And he did it, you know, very effectively. He was very effective.
He knows, or he knew the media.
Yeah.
He knew how the news cycles worked. He knew how to take advantage of them to the utmost effect. And I think we had mentioned here on this show that recently when he went and spoke at CPAC, that he had promised that this election cycle, Obama was going to be vetted, whereas he hadn't been vetted in the prior election. But now that Breitbart has, in effect, changed the media landscape enough so that he can get the word out, and he knows how to...
In a big way.
You know, he knew how to work the media and get these stories out there. He says, I'm going to do... And he said in particular that he had videos of Obama from his college years. And the thought that came to our minds, and I can't remember if we actually said it on the show, was, God, I hope he's got those videos stored in multiple places.
Yeah,
we did.
Because you get worried.
So then you hear he dies, and you think, oh, my gosh, somebody went after him. It turns out he had a heart condition, and he probably just did.
But your mind does go there.
Die of
a
heart attack.
In the world we live in, that's where your mind goes. That's where my
mind
goes.
Yeah, it definitely seems suspicious.
Because I was shocked.
Some people thought it was a hoax. They thought it was one of, like, a stunt that he would pull.
Right. I mean, I woke up, it was really early, 5 or 6 in the morning, and I guess that news hit, and it was unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, really.
Well, and
we had just seen him the week prior, I guess it was the week prior on that video.
Yeah, and tell people the history, because you knew him.
Oh, yeah, I knew about him, and so I contacted him, told him about my work, and basically just trying to get my work out there and ask him how I could do that, and he replied with, in all caps, I love Pigmen. He had heard of Pigmen already, which I find more and more these days. Even Ann Coulter, when I met her, she knew a Pigmen. So from there, I was invited to write something for his website, Big Hollywood, and I did. I wrote about my work, and the editor there and me, we had a falling out, I guess, not 6 or 7 months later. But he had rejected 5 pieces of mine prior to that, so we had little runs here and there. I think Breitbart wanted me there, and the editor did it because Breitbart wanted me there, and that was about it. But he was very aggressive in getting, you know, he wanted basically to have pop culture have a non-leftist, I mean, for non-leftists to have a presence, a big presence in pop culture.
Right.
And
he understood, and he would say this explicitly, that the culture is what drives politics, that politics is not the primary, that it's the content of the culture that's going to influence politics. So he realized that he needed to, for instance, have a site like Big Hollywood that criticized the products that come out of Hollywood for having a certain political slant and things like that.
And you know, I think also it's like when right-wingers, when non-leftists at least, get a chance to go to Hollywood, you see these films about abortion, about the border, and it's like, this is embarrassing stuff. They can write about major things and have that. Maybe those should be as part of the story. But there was one literally called, I think, The Border, literally. And I don't think Breitbart, I don't know if he was explicit about that, but that's not what I think he was pushing for.
Yeah, I don't think he particularly
pushed towards that. Because he leaned right, but he was also near libertarian. He mentioned Atlas Shrugged on Bill Maher's show. And one thing he did also, which was great, he got it out there that Bill Maher is not, as he's been trying to sell himself as, a libertarian. And he got it out of him on his show. And he called him out. He goes, basically, no libertarian would endorse socialized medicine. I think he was talking about Obamacare when it was worded.
No libertarian would donate $1 million
to Obama's
political PAC, right?
So that was, you know, he brought it out of him. He was very effective, and he had them on their heels. He was always on the offense, not defensive. And Robert Spencer wrote that about him the other day. And that was impressive. And he was always fighting, always. I mean, big fights, small fights, petty fights, even on the Twitter. I mean, these little rat leftists going back and forth with them. And I mean, in essence, wasting his time with them, but he felt it was worth it. And, you know, I thought of Andrew, and I met him a few times. We spoke on the phone a few times. And one thing he is that comes to mind is a fighter. And that's what I drew. I drew it's a silhouette with his very recognizable hair and a fist in front of him called Fighter. And I put the date, Andrew Breitbart, 1969, 2012. And that's what he was. He always, you know, it's like he loved it. And you could tell he loved it. Getting in the ring with these guys, getting on their turf, which, you know, most right-wingers wouldn't do. They think it's not their place to go. Well, he went there. He kicked the doors down. And he's built up a big body where they can actually make some damage, I think, in the future, which they will do, especially with these videos of Obama. I hope they hurt him. I hope these videos really hurt him, because if it's videos of a young Obama, who knows what he was saying back then?
Right.
You know, who knows what.
And then it probably will come down to, because I mean, we were just talking about the pitiful state of the Republican candidates, but you'll say, okay, there's an American and there's an anti-American, and at least you're going to vote for the American. That's the better choice. I did a little bit of Twitter exchange last evening with someone named Lee Stranahan, who writes for one of the big sites and stuff, and he was putting together an article on Breitbart, and he assured me that they have a number of big stories in the works. So, we've heard already recently that the videos will be released, so we're glad that
within,
at least some of these
days, within
yeah,
days,
within days, that some of these things that we were promised are actually going to happen.
I hope they do it the way he did the other things with Acorn, you know, step by step, a little here, a little there, to really get them on the defense.
Yeah, you keep them on their heels, because they don't even know what's coming next. So you release a little bit of information, and then they try to come up with a story to react to that, and then you release more that shows that what they just said is false and wrong, and that they're lying again, right? And you release more and more, and just show them to be totally different.
So he was not afraid of falling. He was not afraid of, you know, looking ugly, getting ugly. He was not afraid of that. Like, you know, I said about John McCain the other day, you know, he was a classy loser, you know, John McCain. And Breitbart didn't give a damn to how he looked, how he sounded. He went out there, and
he had an incredible sense of humor, too.
He did.
I mean, we watched, there was an hour-long tribute episode of Red Eye hosted by Greg Gutfeld, and he played a lot of clips of Breitbart basically being a total goof on his show a lot of times, just all these stunts and everything. So he was very whimsical and fun. And Gutfeld had said that his wife called Breitbart the wizard, because basically everywhere they go, he would stir
something
up something to make
happen.
Something fun.
Something
yeah,
would, you know,
You know, we've seen different reactions to his death, and you know, I would say that anybody from an objectivist perspective is going to have a bit of a mixed attitude towards Breitbart, because I don't know that I saw Breitbart as principled, completely philosophically principled.
I think
he was mostly on the right side of any issue
right
that
targets.
I saw him really. Yeah,
he really did. That's what was impressive, and also I don't know. I mean, his willingness to have me on a big Hollywood, I mean, flat out, honestly, a pig man, and the work itself, and you know, it was still considered a little too much for the editor, clearly. But because the falling out was with the Fort Hood massacre, the editor put something up there, and I sent something in. It was a strong pigman piece about retribution, and he said it was inappropriate, and I got angry and went back and forth with him. And then hours later, after we found out that he was a Muslim who screamed Allahu Akbar numerous times, wore white, you know, whatever, the Muslim clothing, and they had written, "We know nothing. We know less than nothing. Let's find out. Let's just put this aside and wait till after Christmas to find out." And that really pissed me off further. So I wrote on there and, you know, had another run-in. And I followed up with Breitbart after I had a falling out with the editor. And he wasn't too happy. He said, "Your strategy wasn't as clear as it could have been, you know." And I said, "Okay, where do we stand?" And he said, "Okay, listen, just write me and we'll go from there." So he wasn't willing to cut me off even after that, which was cool. But he was always out there. And you know,
you didn't really talk too much with him after that? No.
No, we didn't. You know, we saw him at some events here and there.
You know, in terms of, you know, the sort of mixed reviews, one thing you have to give him, and this is a point that, I mean, we've talked about this with respect to people in the past, but I also saw that Scott Halloran had made this point on his little blog post about Breitbart, that if somebody has consciously distance themselves from the left, you know, taken this step of
knows that they're evil of
rejecting the left when they've grown up in an environment where they're just surrounded by
drowning
these people, that you have to give them a lot of credit, even if they're not necessarily all the way in your camp philosophically. Somebody who has come that far. I mean, the other, you know, example is a David Horowitz,
right?
I mean, tremendous.
Yeah.
You know, he goes from being
evolving to the to that
hardcore politically active leftist to switching completely and being one of the best
conservatives. And they're
out
some
there.
Of the best fighters because they know.
Yeah.
They know the mindset of the enemy.
Well, and that's the thing too. That's what makes him valuable too. Breitbart knowing the media.
Yeah.
And so I really hope that he passed along a lot of his wisdom about how the media works to the people who are going to be rolling out this information in the in the coming weeks.
I love his spirit, the in-your-face, you know, rejection of that entire mindset, calling them out, calling them, you know, the scum that they are.
Well, and he would say things like, basically, you have control over your own life. So he would, put things in fairly basic terms sometimes, you know, as maybe not always explicitly philosophical, but he did get sometimes fairly fundamental, at least in the political realm. You know, I was going to ask you, there are people who said, okay, you know, he died of a heart attack and he should have taken it easy.
Right.
He should have given it a rest.
That's
why
he
did
was.
He always have to have his
That's
BlackBerry? Why did he always have to have his iPad and show you his latest project?
This was who he was.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, he made that kind of impact because of that. I mean, you know, he was always on a move, always thinking, always, you know, maybe he didn't sleep much, you know, maybe he didn't. Maybe he just didn't take care of himself.
Well, he said, and this
food,
is one thing that I like about him, is that he said in one of his books, he said that he slept very well at night because he knew that he was actually out there fighting for his values and effect. He didn't say exactly that. But
yeah, but exactly. I think he meant, you know, in one way, not literally. Maybe he didn't sleep much, but I know what you mean.
Yeah,
but
when he did,
that's what kind of person you need.
That's like
on
it's
your
like
side.
The most interesting man. It's Breitbart. He's like, I don't sleep much, but when I do,
right.
I sleep well. Right?
You know, I always seem like he was like a bodyguard for his values, a bodyguard for those things that he loved passionately, and he will defend them to the end. I mean, whether it was in artists and people, writers that he loved, that he defended. Friends. So that's, you know, that was, it was something else. Yeah.
Some people are saying that the quality of Drudge went down tremendously since he left. And I wouldn't doubt that. The other thing that Greg Gutfeld gave him credit for was linking up various people.
Right.
Saying, oh, this one should meet that
right.
one. And he puts them together.
Right.
And then
the
projects would happen.
Right. Gutfeld said, you know, he, that Breitbart introduced him to
Fox News.
To Fox News.
Yeah.
He says without that, he wouldn't have gotten, you know, Red Eye.
Yeah. So.
That's huge. And that's why he, you know, he was on his first episode. And he was in other ones. And
again, that's in his total mission, which was to have non-left ideas
really what it is.
Become,
you know,
part of the culture.
And that's exactly what it is. It wasn't necessarily conservative. It wasn't necessarily, you know, it was non-leftist.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was the subtitle of his book. You know, something about non-leftist.
Yeah, trying to get rid of the leftist domination of
right.
culture and effect.
It was the original subtitle, because he had a book called Big Something, the original of his Righteous...
Righteous Indignation?
Yeah, it was the original title to that. And it was about that. It was about fighting them, calling them out, and trying to get a foothold into pop culture, which he knew was important.
Essential.
You know, which we know is important.
Yeah, and Leonard Peikoff has talked about that recently too.
He did.
Because we as objectivists always talk about, let's get involved in the universities, let's have objectivism as a philosophical movement, have influence in the universities, but it is just as important that you have something like Kira Peikoff's novel
absolutely
out there having an influence in the culture.
Yep.
Or, you know, if we ever do anything great with this talk radio show, if an objectivist talk radio show can ever be super popular,
well, no,
it'd be nice if it could go out there.
I have listened
to
right-wing talk radio for years,
yeah,
and I can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I really can't. It's almost unlistenable at times, the personalities and what they say and their repetitions and their annoying habits. I just can't do it anymore. I would, you know, for something like this, for these ideas to go out there in a big way, that's huge. I just want, you know, one more thing about Breitbart. And there's a guy, none of you know him. His name is David Frum. And one of my friends referred to him, David Frum, the left. He's an insignificant crumb on the right, and that's why I call him David Crumb. I did a drawing of him the other day, and he called, you know, I think that the day Breitbart died, if not maybe hours later, maybe next day, he called him poisonous, you know, And this is a...
supposed right-wing guy.
Right-wing guy. You know, someone else called him David Scum. He's an impotent nobody. You know, Breitbart has made an impact. David Frum can't make an impact. And, you know, this one Ace of Spades, the website, said Breitbart is more alive than David Frum has ever been. That's absolutely true. I mean, you just see even the videos of Breitbart. And that's all. It was just really rotten, ugly, nasty. And the Twitter, the tweets about Breitbart, the moment people found out he died on the left, I mean, it just proves, you know, what they are. Really rotten, ugly things. And someone said, well, you know, he would have loved that. Sure, to an extent. But I don't know. It was just unbelievable, the things that they were willing to say about
him. Well, and this is one of the things that Gutfeld mentioned when he said he thought maybe this was a stunt, because Breitbart, for people who know him on Twitter, he would always retweet the tweets of his critics.
Yes.
And he said he did it basically to let them expose themselves for how ridiculous and stupid and horrible they are.
Someone was trying to call him out by saying that I was associated with him when I was on the Daily Show. And he retweeted that, you know.
Yeah.
As in, yeah, good.
Yeah,
you know,
that's great. No problem.
That was funny.
But, you know, people thought that it would just be right up his alley to fake his death, let all these people say all the horrible, hateful things that they were going to say, because he knows.
I mean, honestly. And
What was it the Rolling Stone did? The Rolling Stone was terrible. What was it?
You said F.U., Andrew, F you, this. They were the whole thing. This is, they slimed him. They are, you know, the scum came out, and they couldn't help it. Because he was not only an opponent, he, you know, really, I mean, affected things. You know, really, really did. He knocked out Acorn. Acorn now is trying to come up, you know, in different ways, under different names. But he knocked him out. He knocked out a piece of crap politician in New York. Another politician as well, someone else. I forgot who his name was. It wasn't just fun and games. It wasn't just a circus that he was, you know, he was effective. And they can't stand that, especially when you know, they get a guy who mocks them the way he did. They got to be mocked. You know, I don't know. He was effective. He really was.
I mean, there's a huge...
You need that kind of person out there.
Yeah, there's a huge organization that he has of people who are going to be carrying out some of the things that he did, but in terms of the mastermind, he's gone. So after a certain amount of these things are out there, will any of them have learned?
Yeah, the willingness to get into the mud with this enemy. I mean, that's...
Well, and almost too much, right? Because he went and had dinner at Bill Ayer's house.
He did. And, you know, Tucker Carlson won something, and they ended up going there. And I don't know. I mean, I hear them. Like, how can you have dinner with that terrorist? I mean, unrepentant terrorist, who basically is Obama's Tui. I mean, he is, you know, I got this idea for a cartoon, you know, unrepentant American terrorist Bill Ayers from bombs to Obama. Because when he saw Obama, he said, okay, I think we can bring it all down from the inside. I can't, you know, the bombs are passe, let's say now. And that's why Obama has a political coming out party at Bill Ayers, the unrepentant terrorist's house, 1995. And they've been friends since. And Obama got away with saying he was just a neighborhood professor. And, you know, McCain didn't call him out. No one called him out. I think Breitbart tried to some extent. Horowitz did. But, yeah.
One more thing on Breitbart before we go on.
I know.
Batten says he noticed how many hate tweets on Andrew Breitbart consisted of calling him gay.
Right.
And what if he was gay? You know, that's the whole point is, you know, why is being gay so bad? Why would they call him gay?
I guess
they're
the
liberals
left,
and being gay shouldn't be bad.
They were using it. Yeah, they were insulting him by that.
Well, it's the same thing as the issue of calling people Muslim, you know?
Yeah. You Muslim?
That's right.
You know.
It's not supposed to be bad. So... Speaking of Obama,
it's like Obama when people quote-unquote accuse him of being Muslim, and they were those kind of slurs, like, those are slurs? Don't you like Muslims?
Right.
Isn't that a compliment?
Right.
But anyway.
Right. What about gays? How are gays slurs, right?
I guess they're taking they're taking into consideration the rights attitude, at least, you know, some on the rights attitude about gays. That's why. But Breitbart was. Totally, you know, I mean, he was for the group Go Proud, the gay conservative group, who was not allowed to be a CPAC this year, by the way, which is one of the things that Amy talked about actually a few weeks ago on the show.
Yeah. Yeah, we're gonna have to talk more about the social issue stuff as time goes on, because I would like to convince religious people that from their own perspective, it is not in their interest to push social issues politically.
No.
And it's not. And I think the best way to do it is from the perspective of Islam, because you'd say, well, look, they have their faith. Right. You have your faith.
Right.
They want their faith to become part of our politics. You want your faith to become part of our politics.
Associate with
them. And the mere fact that your particular faith may have been, you know, believed in by people of our founding generation more than Islam, that doesn't privilege it in any particular way. I mean, what is the right faith? You know, people just have...
So we
need a reason-based government, and we need to keep faith out of government, because if you say, okay, we have a precedent to have faith in government, then whose faith wins? It's whichever one gets the majority vote.
Right.
And
Santorum, when he's a critic of, let's say, Islam and his own Islamic radicalism type thing, is he a critic of Islam, or is he a critic of the competition that Islam poses towards his religion? I mean, is that it?
Is it just the Crusades playing itself out in his mind, or who knows?
Could be.
So let's talk a little bit about Obama, and Deborah in the chat room has gotten in on the pun game here.
I used that in a cartoon for the late John David Lewis. Remember?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's O-B-O-M-B-A.
Right. Obama. So yeah, Bill Ayer is from Bombs to Obama. I got to make that a cartoon.
Yeah. So we've got Obama in a story today in the Wall Street Journal.
One more thing. I'm sorry. Batten writes, Andrew Breitbart went to Ayer's house because he had to see what the prick was like in person in a social setting. AB had balls. He absolutely did have balls. And that's what
he
is
did
missing.
Have balls, but I couldn't see myself eating a meal cooked by Bill Ayer.
I could neither, but he had no quote-unquote decorum, you know? And that's a good thing. In today's world, we are fighting for our lives here, you know, in every way. I mean, every day, against our government, against the enemy, in every way. So in that sense, he wasn't afraid, again, to fall, to look ugly, to get loud, to get in their face, which was impressive.
Yeah.
That's all.
And we have really lost that tremendous amount of energy, which we saw directed in the right direction.
In the right direction. He had the right enemies. You know, he went after him. It doesn't matter if we wouldn't do it that way, let's say. Well, I wouldn't do it that way. Well, he did.
Yeah.
And he did things, and he was effective in a way that the others, the more, you know, respectful ones, would never.
And just think of the potential for all the different things he would do in the future. And like we said, some of these crucial things will be done by
It's like Apple, you know, they will still go on. They will still produce great. He put these great people in charge, and I hope and I think Breitbart did that as well.
Yeah, I hope that's the same. Although Breitbart strikes me as a bit more scattered all over the place than Steve Jobs ever did.
Yeah, but which is why I think he had, you know, a head for each of those sites, you know, an identity,
mm-hmm.
an individual who knew their stuff for that particular subject.
They said typically he was multitasking.
Right.
So a million miles.
He threw everything at the wall.
He was a whirlwind, a million miles an hour.
He threw everything at the wall, and a lot of it did stick.
Yeah. Okay, so here we go. On Obama, we have a story released today, conveniently, because Obama's about to meet with Netanyahu, I believe, tomorrow. Wall Street Journal, March 4th, Obama says force is an option against Iran. So this is supposed to give us hope.
This is campaign speak.
Yeah, yeah.
This is election speak.
Yeah, so who is he speaking to?
Right.
I think it's very important to say who he's speaking to.
Right.
He is speaking to the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is Washington's most powerful pro-Israel lobbying group. So that's who he's speaking to.
And if they don't realize that, you have to basically watch what he does, not what he says. Look at the last 3-4 years. This is who he is. This is what he's done. He's no fan of Israel. He's an enemy of Israel, actually.
He still hasn't visited Israel,
right? No,
he hasn't. So he says he is prepared to employ a so-called military effort to keep Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon. That's the Wall Street Journal's interpretation of what they said. But let me go ahead and give you the actual quotation from Obama, which I'm going to parse a little bit. It says, Obama warned against too much loose talk of war.
you mean from their side, from Iran's side, or...?
I think from our side,
I
too.
I know, because, I'm joking.
He says the rhetoric has aided Tehran by driving up global energy prices and undermining diplomacy Iran.
1 second.
Undermining diplomacy.
Let me just remind, okay? Yeah. Iran says, I want to wipe Israel off the map, America off the map, the great Satan. And we say we have to defend ourselves. And that is rhetoric?
Yes.
And I had this cartoon called I Ran Away From Reality. It's about Ahmadinejad and Obama. Check it out if you can. Sorry.
Yeah, it's on his website. I Ran Away From Reality. Pretty good. This idea of undermining diplomacy with Iran by having too much loose
diplomacy
talk
with
of war.
The state-sponsored terrorism,
and
the greatest on earth.
And this is what he says. He says, which, this diplomacy, he says, still has time to succeed.
Oh man.
When is diplomacy?
After they nuke us, then we can talk some more. I mean, we really talk.
So then he says, I will take no options off the table, and I mean what I say.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine, but I mean, you can have all kinds of options on the table and say, "Well, I'm really not likely to use this option."
We have every moral
option,
right to attack
Iran. But it's
Iran
on the table
today,
right?
Every right for what they've done to us. They've killed Americans for decades.
So he says, "I'll take no options off the table. I mean what I say." Let me continue with this. Is from Obama. He says that includes all elements of American power. He says a political effort aimed at isolating Iran, a diplomatic effort to sustain our coalition and ensure that the Iranian program is monitored, an economic effort to impose crippling sanctions, and yes, and here's what he talks about the military effort, a military effort to be prepared for any contingency.
Contingency.
End quote. Now, that does not, in my mind, if someone says, I have a military effort to be prepared for any contingency, I can see Ron Paul saying that.
Right.
Because Ron Paul has explicitly disavowed any intention of going in preemptively to prevent them from getting nukes. I think the language that he uses here is consistent with that. A military effort to be prepared for any contingency, that could be a reactive
military. Yes, and this to him is still a concession, but he has to because he's trolling for votes, especially from the Jewish community, because they have shown that this guy.
And one of the phrases used here in the story is that he's trying to ease the strained relations with Jewish voters. They call this rhetoric of Obama, more aggressive rhetoric.
I mean,
the mere fact that he talked about military effort.
Yeah, and who is he speaking this to? He's speaking to people who he thinks he could buy them with this, buy their votes through this. He never speaks like this by Iran. When has he ever spoken like this?
Well, and then the other thing that he supposedly hopes to do with this little speech here is that he hopes to make Netanyahu more patient. Hmm. He wants Netanyahu to be patient and not feel like they have to go ahead and strike Iran right away. They want them to wait, give the chance for the sanctions to work, et cetera. So it says the Israeli leader actually has privately conveyed to the White House that he's going to press Mr. Obama on Monday to specify the quote-unquote red lines that would warrant a military strike from the U.S. if Iran crossed them. Mr. Netanyahu also told senior administration officials and U.S. lawmakers in recent weeks that he wants Mr. Obama publicly to clarify his position that all options are open on the table to confront Iran. See, and I would like to hear that too. I would like to hear Obama say, if we see X, then we'll do Y. And what it
you
says
do
here,
this, we do this.
It says, Obama is going to talk about these things with Netanyahu, but it says that he, in this article, again, from Wall Street Journal, he won't publicly lay out his red lines.
So we're not going to know
what these red lines are. But nonetheless, he hopes he's going to meet with Netanyahu. Netanyahu's going to be so excited about what Obama said in the speech today, and so it's going to help to repair the relations between the two leaders, which have been strained by the disagreements. Now, remember last time Netanyahu and Obama met, it was about a year ago, and Obama called for Israel and the so-called Palestinians to use the pre-1967 borders as a starting point for negotiations.
That's
so they were going to use those as the starting point, and then they were going to have these so-called mutually agreed-upon swaps after that.
Only a Muslim would say that. Only a Muslim would say that. I mean that.
I mean, because what it says is that the post 1967 war borders that they had, right?
They were defending themselves.
Those borders that Israel had to claim in order to defend itself, he's saying those are wiped out. Those aren't the starting point. Those aren't justified. Basically, everything you did in the Six-Day War was unjustified. Right. That was what Obama said insisting on those pre-1967 borders as the starting point for negotiations. The fact that the swaps from then on were supposed to be mutually agreed upon, blah, 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 blah,
right,
means nothing. It was a total, total slap in the face to anyone in Israel.
Yes.
And I don't think you can make up for that by...
Where was he in...
Yeah, where was he in 1967? Where was Obama in 1967?
He was in Indonesia. No. Where was it? What's that country that he was in from 6 to 10 years old?
It wasn't Indonesia?
I know the country. I made a cartoon, but basically he was taking Quran class.
Yeah.
Where they teach you that the Jews are the scum of the earth. So that's where he was in those days. So he doesn't want to go back to those days, you know.
And so then listen to this depressing thing. It says the meeting will come, this meeting between Netanyahu and Obama, will come at the start of a week in which world powers are expected to be close to accepting an Iranian offer to do what? Are you ready? To resume negotiations aimed at curbing its nuclear program. Oh, we'll resume negotiations. All they're doing is stalling.
Yep. Yep.
And, you know, we say, and Israel and U.S., you know, our intelligence and everything, we're trying to monitor their program, but it doesn't mean that we have perfect intelligence. So every bit that they're stalling, they're just increasing the enrichment of uranium underground. They might even be building a bomb. Who knows?
We're suckers as far as they're concerned, and we have the ultimate sucker in the White House. Sucker in chief. And yeah, by the way, it was Indonesia. Right.
Yeah.
From 6 to 10 years old, he was going to Quran class as a Muslim. The president of the United States of America, who is a real hardcore Christian now.
Yeah. So I hope Netanyahu is not at all taken in by any of this so called more aggressive rhetoric. Because again, as I read it, yeah, I mean, the Wall Street Journal in the opening paragraph of this story portrays it as he is prepared to employ a military effort to keep Iran from obtaining.
Right,
so they're speaking about that military effort as if he promised to do it in a context of preventative measure. But in the context of the actual quotation from Obama, he says a military effort to be prepared for any contingency.
Right. Are they covering us?
That is meaningless. That's just meaningless. Well, at least they put the actual quotation in the piece. But I think that someone is hearing what he wants to hear out of this. And if I take Obama literally in person, which I love to do, or I hate to do, I don't know. But I think it's very vague, and it could just be we're prepared to react if we get hit by a nuclear bomb.
He was asked by his writers, what do I have to tell them to get their vote? I mean, I can't go all the way, you know. But what do I have to tell them? Just enough, right? Okay, that's it.
People in the chat room say, yeah, buying time.
Yep.
That's what they're doing. And what else do we have in the chat room here? Negotiating with an Ayatollah. Yeah, that'll work.
Huh.
Because Takiya doesn't exist.
No. They can lie their ass off.
Some people are fantasizing about the glass desert of Iran.
Huh.
You know, why didn't we, when we had a chance, go in there and help the Iranian opposition?
Right.
Obama had such an opportunity.
Absolutely right. But he speaks about the Arab Spring. How about, you know, that was something he could have actually done well and say, okay, we have to do this. And, I mean, we have every reason to overthrow them anyway for our own reasons, but also for, you know, those who are fighting against their own government.
And now the news out of Iran as well is that the fundamentalists, as you might call them, Muslims,
The true Muslims
are gaining more political power in Iran as well, just like it's happening all around the Middle East. So it is not good, and I'm not at all heartened by what he says. The only thing, again, I mean, we try to look at these people as politicians. If Obama was to actually do something about Iran, that would, of course, increase his chances for re-election.
He's weighing that in his mind. He goes, should I defend America? If I defend America in this context, I might win again. Let me think about that. You know, and that's the only consideration he has. Maintain power. That's it.
Yeah.
Get power and keep it. That's the goal.
Deborah says, Obama is naturally repelled from acting in ways that would advance life and freedom. Yeah.
I mean, he absolutely is. He is an absolute nihilist.
And he'll do it to the minor extent that he has to in order to stay in power, as far as I can tell.
And you know what? From his ideologies, I mean, you know, communism, Islam, it fits right in. I mean, it totally fits right in. Anti-life ideologies. And he never once questioned them. That's why I call him, he's a communist Muslim. Or a communist with a soft spot for Islam, and a Muslim for with a soft spot for communism, whatever. You know, he's half American, half Muslim, you know.
Let's talk about another one of Obama's triumphs. Are you ready?
Yeah.
The Chevy Volt.
Yeah.
Yay. Who in our chat room owns a Chevy Volt or is eagerly on a wait list to get one of these?
It's a Revolt. It's
a Revolt. Yeah. Chevy Volt, anybody? Nobody in the chat room seems to be stepping up and saying that they are on the list for a Chevy Volt. Well, I think that our little unscientific survey of our chat room in which they are not purchasing the Chevy Volt must be a sign of a larger trend because, as the Wall Street Journal reports, General Motors is idling Chevy Volt output as sales slow. General Motors Company, which of course is Government Motors, right, bailed out by Mr. Obama. Yeah, people in the chat room say, not I, I'm not driving that car. They will idle production of the Chevy Volt battery-powered car for 5 weeks beginning this month because of slow sales amid an effort to boost the vehicle's consumer appeal, the company said Friday. It was launched last year with great fanfare. It says the Volt has had a rocky start as sales stalled, and the car became a lightning rod for critics of the Obama administration's auto industry bailout and support for alternative energy. GM said 1,300 workers at the Michigan factory where the Volt is built will be out of work between March 19th and April 23rd. The plant had just resumed production on February 6th after a prolonged holiday shutdown. So this sounds exactly like another government project. It sounds like another Solyndra. Are you bored that these people are unemployed? Is that it, Bush?
No. I'm just bored. Another thing to do with the government and getting into our
lives, manipulating, planning, right? You know, here you got. I mean, this is
in their mind.
Obama was running GM like a business, right? They're saying, well, look, you know, we think, and here's the thing: if you have a government entity that is not kind of constrained by the need to make a profit,
right?
Then you don't have any of the proper incentives. So the fact that Obama, he's got his pet idea of alternative energy, so it leads him to invest in things like Solyndra that go bankrupt in weird, scandalous ways and waste all sorts of...
Well, he's taking our money.
Just taking the money. But, you know, here we've got this alternative energy kick again, this bent, where you're having a company put out on the market a product that people really aren't ready to buy yet.
The market does not want...
Yeah, and sure, you do have other automobile companies.
But it's a moral car. I mean, it's moral.
Oh, yes, it's moral because it saves the environment. And we talked with Alex Epstein a couple weeks ago.
I think it's Epstein.
My best behavior 2 weeks ago. I did not mispronounce his name. Yeah. No, I know it's Epstein. Okay. And 2 weeks ago, I didn't mispronounce it once. And here I am back from my illness, and I mispronounced it. Poor Alex.
Martin says, I want an immoral car.
Yeah, Martin says
well, they're all immoral except this.
Yeah, there's other cars too, but the only reason that the car companies have gotten into the purely electric car, or maybe even the hybrid cars, is because the government keeps putting mandates on them that the average gas mileage of the cars that they have is below a certain number or above a certain number.
Something somewhere, somehow.
Yeah.
Just push us there.
So the government is pushing the market into positions that it would never happen
ever,
on its own.
Ever.
There wouldn't be a demand for these cars, right?
And that's why government in a lot of ways is unnatural. I mean, we need it, and it is good if it does its job. Outside of that, it's unnatural to be bigger than that. And that's why we get this, stories like this.
Yep. And so here it is, you know, and they're going to be on hold for 5 weeks, and then they come back again and I guess start manufacturing them again. Of course, it won't probably be very efficient because they'll have the startup and everything. It's going to be slow. But think about this. Why is it that people aren't buying these cars? And so they had an article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal entitled Chevy Volt, Why Isn't It Selling Well? And it turns out, there's two things about this car that make it completely a non-seller. One is price. You take a look at it.
No.
I mean, it's not very attractive. A lot of these cars are not that attractive, these hybrids.
There was one actually attractive, but
That was the Tesla that we talked about, right?
And it is attractive.
The Tesla Motors car is good. And
they understand. We've got to make these attractive. They're too ugly.
Wasn't there also an issue of some of the Volts were catching on fire? I heard that several weeks ago.
Deborah writes, I had one, but it caught on fire and exploded. She was joking, probably.
Yeah. So
they're just no damn good.
So Chevy Volt, why isn't it selling well?
The reason why they make them is not for a good reason. It's not for business reasons.
No. They're making it because Obama wants to feel good about doing something for the environment.
And it's something concrete. See? Look.
Period. But it turns out that people in the general public aren't quite as environmentalist and sacrificial
as
Obama, because in the general public, the price matters. And this car, before the rebate that the government gives, is $41,000.
$41,000.
Now, there's a $7,500 government rebate, but if you think of these compact cars and how little you could buy a competing compact car that has very good gas mileage, they were saying that there's actually another GM car, and I can't remember the name of it, that was selling a whole lot more because it had very good gas mileage and it was a lot cheaper. You know, every time that I've ever done the math on any of even the hybrids, the increase in price in the hybrid, you would have to, I mean, gas prices are going to be bad. They are going to be terrible this summer. They're probably going to be over $5 a gallon this summer.
Well, they love the leftists as well. They're like, okay, then more people will buy it. But they still don't buy it. They still don't.
No.
You know, because they stink.
And then the other problem with a fully electric car is the practicality, because these have to be plugged in
for hours to a point where, you know, we know someone who does that.
Yes.
And they have to do it. And, sometimes, I mean, he can't go from one place to another just without, he has to, I guess, charge it for a while before he drives back.
People in the chat room are talking about how long does the battery last. And I am under the impression that the range of the battery is quite small. And I think it's probably on the order of like 75 miles or something at the most before you would have to charge the car up again. A lot of these ones that are made by General Motors and the other big car makers, they don't have a large range. It does say that there is a backup gas motor within the Chevy Volt. The GM Volt. But is it Chevy?
I don't know.
I can't.
Chevy Volt. That sounds right.
Yeah, it sounds right. Yeah, the Chevrolet Cruze, for instance, is the competing car. Yeah, so the Chevy Cruze gets up to 42 miles on a gallon of gasoline. It's just a gasoline car that is very, very efficient, and it costs half the price of the Volt. So, of course, you're going to buy that. Even though you're going to use gasoline, it's more convenient because you don't have to do this plug-in thing. It's got a larger range. It's cheaper. Of course, you're going to buy that instead. But, yeah, these have very short range. Only Tesla and maybe a couple other of the kind of boutique electric car manufacturers have been able to create batteries for their cars that have a long range, an extended range of, I think, 180 miles.
Is that right?
Something like that. Yeah. So the man that we know who has one of these electric cars, I think he's got the Honda version of the electric car. He has to, of course, plug it in at home. And then once he gets to work, he has to plug it in there in order to make it back home again. It's just not practical at all. So, of course, they're not selling. And it doesn't say in this article.
Well, it's a lie. Lies don't sell in that sense. I mean, it really is built on a lie.
I would love to see how much money of your tax dollars, my tax dollars, are being wasted in this money pit of the Chevy Volt.
It's their dream somehow, some way to deny what is. It just, that's it. And this is a prime example of that.
Yeah. They asked someone at Edmunds.com, which is a car site where you can do all sorts of research on cars. It says the price premium on the Volt just doesn't make economic sense for the average consumer, where there are so many fuel-efficient gasoline-powered cars available, typically for thousands of dollars less.
And Obama drives one of those, right? And every politician who, they drive one of these?
Oh, yeah. They should all drive one.
No, but they don't they? Don't,
yeah.
Right? And they all have, I mean, this is their car, right?
Right.
Everyone who endorses this kind of car drives one.
I think Obama should drive a Volt.
Well, they have to, and they should, or else they're telling us that they are full of crap. And we know that, but, it's a proof positive.
GM on Thursday said it sold 1,023 Volts in February. That's actually pretty funny. But the Volt had a large backlog of unsold vehicles, while the Leaf is actually in short supply. So the Nissan Motors electric car, which is called the Leaf, is in short supply. I guess, you know, imagine this. Nissan, even though it is, you know, being pushed into doing this probably by government regulation, it's probably producing according to demand a lot more than is a government-run motor company, right?
No doubt. Because, so they can afford to, in their own mind, maybe have some of these on the side.
Yeah, so that, you know, for instance,
take a hit.
GM says,
to feel good, I mean.
GM says, hey, we want to sell 10,000 vehicles, and so we just are going to produce as if we're going to sell 10,000 vehicles, and then it says they sold only 7,700. Whereas I bet Nissan is saying, okay, well, we're going to gauge our production according to what we actually sell in the real market, in the real world.
We could take a hit on these in the small percentage. I mean, that's it. Because, you know, to make themselves feel better.
Cost of doing business. So I'm not going to run out and buy one of these right away. What about you? No.
I already have one.
You already have one?
Yeah.
Wow. So other topics.
No, just
what about the Oscars?
The Oscars was pretty good.
You know, there was one thing I wanted to talk about with the Oscars, which was what's his name?
Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yeah, Sacha Baron Cohen came on the red carpet, and he was in full costume
as
his movie character, the dictator.
It's basically a Muslim dictator, and that's what he's playing.
Right.
And it looks funny.
Yeah.
And he's mocking it. Without saying I am a Muslim dictator, but you know it is a Muslim dictator. He has a big beard and a whole, and he popped up on the red carpet, and he had
an urn,
and it was the remains of
Kim Jong-il,
who was his tennis partner.
Yeah, he said, this is my tennis partner, and so he brings this with him.
And
poor Ryan Seacrest.
Ryan Seacrest.
Yeah, poor Ryan Seacrest got the urn, the contents of the urn.
Kim Jong-il. All over his tux.
Spilled all over him. And so the joke was, you know, whenever they're on the red carpet, they say, well, who are you wearing? You know, I'm wearing Yves Saint Laurent. I'm wearing Calvin Klein. No, I'm wearing Kim Jong-il, right?
It was funny. And, you know, people are saying, whatever, it's not. He's funny. He's a funny guy.
Here's the question, right? This is the controversial question. We only have a couple minutes, but I want to talk about it a little bit. The question that came up was whether Sacha Baron Cohen doing that on the red carpet, whether that was the equivalent of the incident in the 1970s of somebody streaking across the stage at the Oscars.
Absolutely not. This is funny, organized. He's playing his character, the Muslim dictator. And it's outside of the actual show. I mean, it was on the red carpet.
Right. I think it makes a difference that it's out on the red carpet.
I think so, too. And also, you know, that was – no one knew about that guy streaking. It wasn't part of the show.
Yeah.
You know, he actually designed this thing, and he dressed up as a character and all that. And
by the way, the women who were flanking him during you can Google and find it on watch videos and everything. But the women who were flanking him were perfect.
Yeah.
They were so stone-faced.
They did not, very attractive.
They did not break character
and
at all.
I think what he was doing was he was playing up on Libya's dictator.
Yeah, Gaddafi.
Who had that?
Yeah.
Look, this guy is funny. If you haven't seen the trailer to The Dictator, check it out. His whole website is written in a type of Arabic you could translate into English. The life story of the guy, of the dictator, is hilarious. I mean, I'm looking forward to it. And again, he's mocking the enemy.
So you don't think this is the kind of smear that...
Absolutely not. It's not. It's just, it's generally funny, and it's targeting what? Our enemy. You know? In a good way. Mocking him for the fool that he is. You know, every single enemy, whether it's the Muslim enemy or the other ones.
And I also think it makes a difference that he was in character as a movie character that he was playing, which is kind of part of the whole spectacle as well. So I didn't see it, but it may be true as well, because if you think about the red carpet, I mean, here's the argument on the other side. The red carpet is supposed to be this elegant, sophisticated, stars are supposed to be showing up, etc. But
he was in character. I thought it was very funny.
Overall, I tend to agree with you. So we are running out of time here. I thank you, all of you who are hanging out in the chat room and everywhere else, for joining us today. I hope you enjoyed the interview with Kira Peekoff and the rest of the topics that we discussed today. During the week, you can connect with me at my blog, don'tletitgo.com, or on Twitter. It's Amy Peikoff, as if that's all one word, on Twitter. I also have a page for the show on Facebook. It's the Don't Let It Go Unheard page on Facebook. And if you want to look at any of Bosch's excellent cartoons, many of which are on the topics that we talked about here, also a great portrait of Andrew Breitbart, check it out at Faustin, faustin.blogspot.com. And then most importantly, if I can ask you guys to do anything, if you enjoy this show, do please tell your friends, spread the word, because this is just a two-man show, as we call it. And
well, it's her show, and I'm just a sidekick. But
we're trying to follow in the grand tradition
of
Breitbart and bring some good ideas into the culture.
Big. Hope it gets to the point where it can be picked up by someone. Because it deserves to be. And
if you know an agent, send them our way. Yay! Thanks, everybody. Have a good evening, and we will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks.